Hercules, Prometheus. What in the world do these myths have to do with Jesus? Let's talk about it with Louis Marcos on Steve Brown, etc.
He's an old white guy, an author, broadcaster, and seminary professor who's sick of religion. And he's brought friends. Please welcome Steve Brown, etc.
And we're so glad you're here. You always have a place at our table. I'm Steve, the aforementioned old white guy. A lot of the people that we're going to be talking about during this hour are friends of mine. When you're old, you get to reference things that young people have no idea about. Matthew Porter, our executive producer, is with us. Some men look at a third helping of turkey and dressing and ask why. Matthew looks and asks, why not? And our video director and IT guy, John Myers, is in his tech bunker considering all of the problems with 2020. John wonders if anybody has tried restarting the whole thing. Just reboot it. I like that.
Reboot.
IT, have you turned it on and off again?
Who knows? Might work. If time is the way C.S. Lewis taught us it was, we maybe could pull that off. Our producer, Jinx, is in his little glass booth. Jinx has been pondering a major theological and existential question. Do you say a blessing before eating Thanksgiving leftovers, or has it been blessed already? If anybody has an opinion on this, I'm open.
Wow.
Never thought of that, did you, Kathy?
Well,
no,
we've got outside of
Dr.
space
George
and time.
I didn't think of that because, you know, you
Steve's
don't have to.
Steve's running away from the question. You see that?
He is. You know, you don't have
You're
to bless.
You're the pastor here.
You don't have to bless appetizers. Everybody knows
That's
that
true.
Part.
That's true.
Listen, so, do you have to tithe the income tax checks when you get them, or have you already tithed on them?
Oh, that's deep.
It's a similar, though more important and
let me get ordained and I'll find out.
Than the one Jinx asks.
Good one.
Dr. George Bingham is the president of Key Life. Radio stations that listen to us are already playing Christmas music, and George, as Zach might say, is here for it. And Kathy Wyatt is the soft, feminine side of the program. Kathy has created the ultimate side dish for 2020, masked potatoes.
Sorry, everybody.
That's so bad.
Matthew.
There's like 14 different foods in a Thanksgiving meal you could make jokes about.
That's
You'll
true.
Hear about
you come
the
up
next
with masked
probably.
Potatoes.
We've got a
potatoes.
Couple of shows before then.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh,
guys, Louis Marcos, our guest, serves as professor in English, scholar and resident at Houston Baptist University. He also holds the Robert H. Ray Chair in Humanities and speaks widely on ancient Greece and Rome, C.S. Lewis and Tolkien. And Lewis has written 18 books. Whenever he burps, they publish it. And his latest, which I hold in my nicotine-stained fingers, is The Myth Made Fact, Reading Greek and Roman Mythology Through Christian Eyes. Hey, Louis, thanks so much for taking your time to be with us.
Thanks. It's great to be on.
You know, our daughter, Robin, works at Key Life. She is an editor and edits everything that everybody writes, including me. And she rarely pays much attention to this particular show. She listens and she may comment on occasion. I can't think of a single time when she has said to me, bring that book to me. I want to read it. So listen, if everybody responds the way our daughter Robin does, you're going to make a lot of money.
I hope so. I mean,
wouldn't that be nice for a change with Christian books?
It would be nice. The publisher has just gone all out, pulled out all the stops, and I'll start with a funny story. When I wrote the original version of this book and sent it to Classical Academic Press, it was about 60,000 words. And they said, we love this, but we want twice as much. A publisher never says that. They say, we want half as much. And so we expanded every chapter, added all the study questions, because we all feel like this is the time for a book about mythology and Christianity, a time when the only thing saving Hollywood is Marvel superheroes. People are interested in myths again, the real myths, not the new ones, but the original ones.
Wow.
Let me, that is so cool. Never had a publisher say they want more ever in a thousand times. Never
like a sound guy asking for more guitar material. Doesn't happen.
Man, Jesus must be on his way back really soon. This is a great book, by the way, and it's a fun book, and it'll take you places where most of the people who are listening on the radio stations and watching the video on our YouTube channel, most of the people, I suspect, haven't been here. And so, Lewis, you're going to have to keep the fodder down low, and you're going to have to start from scratch. First, how can a Christian be interested in dead gods that never existed anyway, and myths that are lies, and then try to connect it with the truth of the Christian faith? Well, that's two questions. Talk to us a little bit about your interest in mythology.
Well, let's just dive in here. About 12 years ago, I published a book with InterVarsity called From Achilles to Christ, Why Christians Should Read the Pagan Classics. And I talked about the Iliad, the Odyssey, the Aeneid, and the Greek tragedies. But I felt like I wanted to go deeper. I wanted to go behind the epics and tragedies to the raw material that underlies all of it. And those are the myths. Now, I got to tell you, Steve, that as a Western man, these myths are part of my heritage. However, I am actually Greek, 100% Greek. Well, according to my DNA test, I'm 92% Greek. But all four of my grandparents were born in Greece, came to America about 1930. So these are also in my blood. And I've always loved mythology. And this is going to sound strange, but I often read Greek myths almost devotionally. Sometimes I grow more spiritually reading mythology than reading just, any old plain devotional. And how is this possible? The reason it's possible, Steve, is a absolutely essential theological distinction that is there in Catholicism just as much as it's in Calvinism. I mean, it is at the core of Christianity, and it's the distinction between special revelation and general revelation. Special revelation is the way that God speaks directly in the Bible, through the prophets, through Christ himself. And before the coming of Christ, the only people that got special revelation were the Jews. And I don't know about you, Steve, but that often bothered me. I thought, you mean God ignored 99% of the rest of humanity until the coming of Jesus? It didn't make sense. Well, again, only to the Jews did he give special revelation, but to the rest of mankind, he gave general revelation. What does that mean? It's the way God speaks through creation, the way he speaks through our conscience, through our reason, through our imagination, and a phrase from C.S. Lewis, he spoke through the good dreams of the pagans. Okay, Steve, we're all made in God's image. God has written eternity on the hearts of men, that famous verse from Ecclesiastes. Or as Augustine says in the beginning of the Confessions, O Lord, you have made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they rest in thee. God has put that desire and that restlessness in all people. Now, that desire alone can't save us. We need the special revelation, and of course, we need grace to be saved. But that yearning makes us desire and reach and grope after God. And a lot of those gropings and wrestlings and yearnings find their way, I believe, into these Greek myths. And so the Greek myths are like signposts. They're pointers towards the truth. Now, thankfully, we have the Bible as our touchstone and our measuring rod, our yardstick. But still, we can find truth. And I hope we'll have time to talk about it, because when I say we can learn truth from myths, I don't just mean let's use a myth as a sermon illustration because it's pretty. I mean that there's actual goodness, truth, and myth if we have eyes to see and ears to hear as we delve into these myths. God did not ignore the pagans. He reached out. And when Jesus was incarnated, he not only fulfilled the law and prophets, he fulfilled the highest yearnings of the pagan peoples.
That's Louis Marcos. His book is Myth Made Fact. I suspect with all of us, you guys are going to be thinking some new thoughts today. You probably always thought a myth was a lie. You didn't know that maybe God was busy writing some stories that weren't special revelation, but were there all along for the people to find. This is a book that would make a great discussion for a small group as you pursue places and go down roads you've never gone. You're listening to Steve Brown, etc. We're going to rest up, and like Jesus, we're coming back.
Hi, this is Eric, producer of Steve Brown, etc. If you've been listening very long, you know I'm a struggling believer, and I'd love to share some things that have helped. At Key Life, we believe that the deepest message of the ministry of Jesus and the Bible is the radical grace of God for sinners and sufferers. And we have four mini books that'll help you believe that no matter what you've done or what you're going through, God's not mad at you. Feeling Guilty, Suffering, and Faith and Doubt by Steve Brown will help you apply healing biblical truth to where it hurts the most. And my mini book, The Gift of Addiction, How God Redeems Our Pain, shows that coming to the end of ourselves is actually the beginning of faith. These four mini books are in the Grace for Sinners and Sufferers mini book combo, and it's available at keylife.org for a suggested donation of $12. They're also individually available for a suggested donation of $4.
Welcome back, and welcome me back, too. I'm having some internet connection problems, so I disappeared, and everybody on this program thought the rapture had occurred. They had been left, but it was technology.
I was scrambling for the material.
Trying to fix my internet connection, but at any rate, we're so glad you're with us. Our guest is professor and author Louis Marcos, and his latest book is titled The Myth Made Fact, Reading Greek and Roman Mythology Through Christian Eyes.
So, Louis, I want to ask a question. You know, you talked about using Greek myths as that God is in there. I almost think of like, you know, if you put a piece of paper over a leaf and trace over it, it's not a photo. It's not the actual thing, but there's the essence of it trying to kind of coming through. I wonder if you could give us an example of what you're talking about, where you see strains of the gospel of the truth bleeding through these pagan stories.
I'll tell you, the best example is actually the origin of the title of my book, The Myth Made Fact. I'm sure most of your listeners are aware that C.S. Lewis, the greatest apologist of the 20th century, spent half his life as an atheist. But what a lot of people don't know is C.S. Lewis did not go directly from atheism to Christianity. That's the story of Chuck Colson, Lee Strobel, Josh McDowell. But Lewis first became a theist, a believer in God. And then it took him about a year and a half to come to believe that Jesus was the Son of God. What was holding him back? Well, I'm sure all of you consider Lewis a role model, but I'm lucky enough to have him as a double role model because he was an English professor like I am. And like me, he loved mythology. And he loved to study comparative mythology and comparative anthropology. And he was a fan of a book called The Golden Bough by Sir James Frazer. And in The Golden Bough, Sir James Frazer was looking for archetypes, certain characters or images or themes that recur again and again across culture, across time. And if you've ever heard of Joseph Campbell, James Frazer was the Joseph Campbell of his day, looking for archetypes like the wise old man, Gandalf, and, you know, Obi-Wan Kenobi, right? That sort of thing. And what Sir James Frazer discovered was a character he called the Corn King. And the Corn King are these strange stories spread throughout antiquity of a god or a demigod coming to earth, dying, often a violent death, and returning. Now, it's not exactly a resurrection. It's more of a seasonal return, right? I'm calling you from Houston here. We don't have four seasons, but you all have four seasons. Well, no, you're in Florida. You don't know what seasons are either. Well, people do, right? And the idea of life, death, and rebirth. So if you're an Egyptian, your corn king is named Osiris. If you're a Greek, you call him Adonis or Bacchus. If you're Babylonian, you call him Tammuz. If you're Persian, you call him Mithras. If you're Norse, you call him Balder. And all these stories were out there. And C.S. Lewis thought that, well, Jesus was just the corn king of the Hebrews, just another myth. And you know what? If you go on the atheist websites and podcasts, they'll try to say, look, we have lots of stories that sound like Jesus. That proves Jesus is a myth. It does not. Let me segue for a second. If you went to a public school like I did and took social studies in sixth grade, because they don't teach history in our country, you took social studies in sixth grade, they had you read the wonderful Epic of Gilgamesh, right? And that has a flood story. And if you have the same teacher I did, she said, now, children, we know that every ancient culture has a universal flood story. That just proves that Christianity, the Bible, is a myth. And even at that age, I thought, you know, there's another way to read that data, right? If everybody has a flood story, maybe there was a flood and only in the Bible did it retain historical value. Okay, let's go back to C.S. Lewis. He couldn't get over this hurdle. Isn't Jesus just a myth and nothing more? And then one day he was taking a long night walk on the grounds of Magdalen College, Oxford, with his good friend J.R.R. Tolkien, a strong believing Catholic. And Tolkien said to Lewis, Lewis, let's think about this a different way. Did you ever think that maybe the reason Jesus sounds like a myth is that he's the myth made fact, the myth that came true? And that revolutionized Lewis. Within a week, he believed that Jesus was the Son of God. Now, how does this work? All right. If it is true that we are all made in the image of God, then God has put that yearning in all of us. As St. Paul says at the Areopagus, right? Out of one man, God created all races of men, and he set the time and the places, though he is not far from any of us, for we grope after him and reach after him. And I believe that one of the ways the pagan people, the Gentiles in general, reach after God was by coming up with these myths of God's coming to earth and dying and rising again. But these are just myths. They're often violent. They're often bloody. They're terrifying. Now, here's the point. If when Jesus came into the world and affected our salvation, incarnation, crucifixion, resurrection, if he did that and that event cycle spoke to the Jews, in other words, it fulfilled the Old Testament law and prophets, that's great. But what about if those events were absolutely meaningless to the Gentiles? If that were the case, it would appear as if a foreign God had invaded us. But that's not the case. When Jesus died and rose on that first Easter weekend, he also, as I said before, fulfilled the pagan yearnings. And so those myths are not proof that Christianity is a myth. Those myths are pointers that point to the actual dying and rising God who did it not in some mythic no man land, but at a specific time and place under Pontius Pilate. So again, the argument that a lot of atheists are using against Christianity is, I think, one of the strongest arguments for it. Jesus is the savior of the world, Jew and Gentile alike.
Man, that is so good. In other words, God was preparing for his major act. It's so that a Greek could say, I got it.
Yeah.
And an animist could say, I got it too. And a Jew could say, oy vey, I've got it too. That's not surprising and to be expected that God would do something like that, right?
And there was a great missionary that died fairly recently named Don Richardson, who wrote a book called The Peace Child and another great book called Eternity in Their Hearts. And he said, if you look in these tribal groups, you will find what he called redemptive analogies. And I believe Greek mythology has those redemptive analogies. And I'm a Western man. I want to see the Chinese Christians go look for those analogies in China and the Japanese in Japan, because I believe they're there.
Oh, man, I read that book, and it absolutely blew me away. I grew up near the Cherokees.
Oh, really?
And their stories are unbelievable. In the mountains of North Carolina, I listened to those stories and thought, you know, that kind of sounds like what I believe. Just got some different names and facts. According to Louis Marcos, that's the myth made fact. And we're going to talk about it when we come back. You got to get this book. You'll go places you haven't gone before and with great delight and joy. Don't you go away, because we're coming back.
From Key Life comes two mini books, What Do You Do for a Living? And Life After Retirement. What Do You Do for a Living by Justin Holcomb addresses the problem of defining ourselves by what we do and how we perform in our work instead of by who we know, a gracious, loving God who defines who we are. Life After Retirement by Steve Brown examines how those transitioning from work to retirement often experience a loss of purpose in life, and how the quest for personal significance can best be answered by God's radical grace, love, and purpose for our lives sufficient to carry us through this transition. What Do You Do for a Living and Life After Retirement can help guide people struggling with either work or retirement. These two Key Life mini books are available through keylife.org for a donation of $6.
Hey, we're so glad you're here. Thanks for joining us. We're hanging out with professor and author Louis Marcos. You can keep up with him on Twitter at Lou, L-O-U, Marcos, M-A-R-K-O-S. And you'll get some of his political views, which he hasn't shared with us. Given the division, we need this job. And so, Louis, keep them to yourself until we finish this hour. And then you're free to say whatever you want, whenever you want to say it.
Louis, you write about a tale of your own, where you engaged with a very devout fundamentalist Christian, and but you describe him as kind of a modernist or person of the Enlightenment orientation, and I'm interested in just seeing how you would contrast that with the direction we seem to be going. With a much more postmodern perspective and how the myths impact differently or how people might deal with them differently.
Several years ago, there was a radio evangelist. He was actually in somewhere in Florida. And this is a good man of God. I'm not going to say his name. I'm not going to make fun of him because he was a good man of God. But he was saying on the air, don't read C.S. Lewis. He's bad. And I had a friend who said, can you come talk to him? And we sat down and talked. And as I expected, He hadn't read anything by C.S. Lewis. He'd seen something online. That was not a surprise. The surprise that has stayed in my mind, it's over a decade now, was I said, "Sir, what have you read by C.S. Lewis? Have you read the Chronicles of Narnia?" And his response was, "Ever since I became a believer 40 years ago, I have not read a single work of fiction." He didn't even read Christian. He didn't even read the Left Behind series, which might be a good thing. But anyway, he didn't read any. And again, if you were to ask that man, "Why don't you read fiction?" he would say, "Because I'm a Christian." But after much prayer and thought, I realize the real reason he doesn't read fiction, the reason he doesn't know, is that he's a modernist without knowing it. What do I mean by that? An Enlightenment modernist is somebody who does what some have called the Enlightenment split. It's either reason or emotion. It's either reason or imagination, logic or intuition, history or myth, science or religion. And there's nothing in between. And this is false. This is an Enlightenment narrative that is 200 years old. Folks, I'm obviously a very conservative Christian. I have no idea with six literal days. I have no problem reading the Bible that way. But we must not turn the Bible into a science textbook, or we're going to lose. Because if you try to hold the Bible to a system of reading that's only existed for 200 years, you're going to lose, okay? So yes, the Bible tells us historically accurate things, but it's never meant to be a modern textbook. Now, why is this? I think this is important at any time, but it's more important today. We have to break down this split because we have a generation of students who we can do our logical, scientific, historical apologetics, and I do that myself, and it's helpful. But if you want to reach this generation, you have to have the best story. You have to show them that Christianity gives us the meta-narrative, the overarching story of creation, fall, redemption, and reconciliation, and that all other stories fit into that. These kids may say they're postmodern relativists, and they may think they are, but they all watch Marvel comic book movies because they know there's good and evil. They are looking for a hero, and they're looking for a sacrificial hero. The last one, Endgame or whatever it was called, the moment of sacrifice is so powerful in that movie because it is written in our DNA. We are part of a story that's going on. And I want to tell you, the folks listening, something. Okay, I'm not going to argue how old the earth is, okay? But whether the earth is 6,000, 6 million, that doesn't make a difference. God really begins his redemptive plan in human history, not with the Tower of Babel, but with Abraham, right? God is working in creation, flood, Babel, but the real historical focus of the gospel begins with Abraham. Abraham is only 4,000 years. That means if you live to the age of 80, if you're a good old white guy like Steve, if you live to the age of 80, your lifespan makes up 2% of that 4,000 years. So don't let yourself be scared away by millions and billions of years. We, all of us, are a significant part of the historical gospel that God is working out in human history. And we've got to reach out to these children. We've got and young adults and use the myths to show them that Jesus is the ultimate hero, that every story they love and cherish ultimately points to Jesus, the one who is the myth made fact, the true hero, the true Hercules, even the true Bacchus, the one who is the Lord of all creation, who died and rose again and defeated not only Satan and sin, but defeated death itself.
Oh, man. I don't know about you guys, but I feel like I'm drinking from a fire hydrant. And there's so much here. I'm going to just sit around for the next week and process it. And then I'm going to tell everybody that I know, you got to get this book. It's called The Myth Made Fact, Reading Greek and Roman Mythology. And when you read it, you'll rise up and call Louis Marcos blessed for having written it. There's some more coming, and the best is yet to come. So, this is not a good time to leave. You've got this. More of the same after we make a buck. he was irritated when the electricity went out. No television, no music, no Netflix. Then he discovered that the battery on his smartphone was dead. He decided to make some coffee, but when he went to the kitchen, he realized that without electricity, he couldn't even do that. Then he noticed his wife in the kitchen, and he sat down and talked to her. He said later, "You know, she seemed like a very nice lady." I know, technology's good, but sometimes go talk to somebody face to face. You might be surprised how nice and real they are. It's messy sometimes, but Jesus would like it. I'm Steve Brown. You think about that. Share what you just heard with a friend. Go to youthinkaboutthat.com. Talking with Louis Marcos, and he is an absolute delight. We've had fun during this hour, and it's not over yet. Louis, you got a lecture series that people can get to, can't they? Tell us a little bit about that.
Okay, the publisher of this book is Classical Academic Press, and I love classical Christian schools and classical homeschoolers, speak for them all the time. And to accommodate the growing interest, Classical Academic Press now has something called Classical U, and it's one of those subscription services where you can watch all sorts of lecture series, particularly on the classics and all different topics. And what they asked me to do was to do a lecture series, audiovisual, to accompany this. So it's not me reading out loud the book. It's me redoing it, speaking directly to the camera. And there's 18 episodes of about 30 minutes each. So it's about 9 hours long. And it takes you through it, but in a different way, telling the story, speaking a little bit more informally, almost like we're speaking here. You can do that as well. So I'm glad that they're expanding and trying to reach people, because I believe there's a wonderful book called How the Irish Saved Civilization. And the pagan classics were saved by the least likely people, these monks in the middle of nowhere. Well, as we enter a new dark age, it's going to be the classical Christian homeschoolers, the people who used to be Bible-only people, who are going to help preserve the pagan classics. And I want my book to be part of that preservation.
All right, check it out. By the way, and it's another story, and maybe we'll explain it sometime, but Louis practiced in front of a microwave oven. He ruined the popcorn, but he learned timing for these lectures.
That's how I can count down to 30. I keep an eye on it. It's great.
Louis, on a little bit of a lighter note, I really want to know what your favorite, if you have one specifically, you might have more than one, but if you have a favorite myth and why, and what do you, and why is it your favorite? In other words, what do you take away from it that makes it your favorite?
Now, let me talk about one I haven't done in any other interviews, because it's a light one. It's wonderful. It's so Greek, and it's one of the few Greek myths that has a happy ending, because a lot of them have unhappy endings. And it's a story of an old couple named Baucis and Philemon, who were living in Phrygia, which is a part of modern day Turkey. And they were living in a town of pretty much evil people, a town very much like Sodom and Gomorrah. And the gods were fed up with that town, and they decided they wanted to test the people. And so Zeus, the king of the gods, and Hermes, the messenger of the gods, or Jupiter and Mercury in the Roman version, they come down to the town to test the people. And they come down as strangers. And for Greeks, the whole Mediterranean world, hospitality is incredibly important. Xenia is the word, the guest-host relationship. And if you see a stranger, you're supposed to take them into your home and feed them before you even ask their name. If you've read the Odyssey, it's all underwritten by this idea of guest-host relationship. And all these evil people beat the gods from their doors, showed no hospitality. Only this poor elderly couple, Baucis and Philemon, showed the proper hospitality. And they let the people in. They had almost no food, but what little meat they had, they served. They had a tiny flagon of wine. All the food they had for the next month, they served there. but they notice that when the god reached for the flagon for more wine, it magically filled. And every time they reached for more food, there was more food. And that pious old couple realized, and they bowed down and said, "Forgive us, we did not recognize you." And Zeus and Hermes regained their form and said, "You are the only hospitable and pious people in this town. We are now going to destroy the town, but if you flee up the hill and do not look back, you will be preserved." And so exactly like a Sodom and Gomorrah story, they ran up and they didn't look back. And when it was done, they turned around, and as they watched, their little hut transformed into a mighty temple, and they were allowed to be the priest and priestess of the temple. And so their hospitality saved them. And we need to realize that in the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, there's two things going. There is the illicit sexuality. We can't get around that. We can't politically correct it. But it also is a breach in hospitality. And one of my favorite verses in Hebrews is that you should always show hospitality, but for by so doing, some have entertained angels unaware. And hospitality is one of my gifts as a Greek. Now, the reason I tell you that is it not only shows you that the pagans understood the importance of hospitality, which, by the way, is listed as one of the spiritual gifts in the New Testament. That's actually a gift. But I want to tell it that to sort of end this wonderful time I've had with you, because it has a direct biblical parallel. Because when Paul and Barnabas were on their first missionary journey, they were in this same area of Turkey where this story took place. And some of you will know the story that by the power of Christ, they healed a cripple. And then all the pagans went wild and they called the two of them Zeus and Hermes, and they started to sacrifice to them. And Paul's like, "No, no, no, don't do this. We're only men." Now you all know the wonderful secret behind the story. It's almost for sure that the reason the people did that is they knew the story. It was in Ovid. Ovid's Metamorphosis wrote that story about 30 years before Christ was born, even closer to the birth of Christ. And then we're going to make the same mistake again, folks. We're not going to. But what's wonderful is it turned out that it wasn't Zeus and Hermes. It was Christ in disguise, but not literally Christ in disguise, but the spirit of Christ indwelling the two of them, preaching the message to these people. So again, God prepared the pagan world, I believe, in all sorts of wonderful and unexpected ways. And here's a wonderful link between a myth and an event in the book of Acts.
Wow.
Oh, Lewis, that is so good. I can hardly stand it. And we got about a minute left. You will be remembered by posterity for your final words. So if you got, I wish I could bottle you and pass you around. Hey, speak to us shortly and quickly. Some final words.
The final words is that, again, these heroes, they all point to Christ. They're self-sacrificial, they're brave, but they're always flawed. I mean, basically in the same way that Samson in the Old Testament is a type of Jesus, right? Samson messes up everything, but he still, think about Samson. He defeated the enemy through his death, right? When he pulled down the temple and died, he killed more Philistines then than all the other things he did. And so in his death, he destroyed death. But he was a flawed hero, yet he points to Christ. And I believe a lot of the pagan heroes in a similar way also point to Christ.
Oh, Lewis, we're out of time. And man, this hour has absolutely flown. I hope that you will find it in your heart to do this with us again. It was a fun time. God bless you, man.
Thanks. Would love to come back.
Hey, guys, great. we're gonna back out for a little bit, sell a product, and then we're going to come back and we're going to tell you who we're going to do it unto next week. Meanwhile, write this down. The title is Myth Made Fact, Reading Greek and Roman Mythology by Dr. Lewis Marcus. You'll be so glad that we told you about it. Now, don't go anywhere or you'll get the fever and die.
Hi, this is Eric, producer of Steve Brown, Etc. If you've been listening very long, you know I'm a struggling believer, and I'd love to share some things that have helped. At Key Life, we believe that the deepest message of the ministry of Jesus and the Bible is the radical grace of God for sinners and sufferers. And we have four mini books that'll help you believe that no matter what you've done or what you're going through, God's not mad at you. Feeling Guilty, Suffering, and Faith and Doubt by Steve Brown will help you apply healing biblical truth to where it hurts the most. And my mini book, The Gift of Addiction, How God Redeems Our Pain, shows that coming to the end of ourselves is actually the beginning of faith. These four mini books are in the Grace for Sinners and Sufferers mini book combo, and it's available at keylife.org for a suggested donation of $12. They're also individually available for a suggested donation of $4.
You're listening and have been listening to Steve Brown, Etc., and it's been so good to have you as a part of this. A great hour of Louis Marcos, and he reminds us of something about which most people are blind. You know, we see the Christian faith as this little thing that we place off into the corner and run to when we get scared or we can't get people to forgive us. God will, because that's his job description, or to keep us out of hell. But it's not that. The Christian faith and the meta-narrative of the Bible permeates everything. And when you become aware of that, you see it everywhere. If you're a missionary, you see it in the writings of people who have never heard about Christ as their stories met Christian narrative. You find it in mythology, and we've been talking about that for the past hour. And in the face of silly, superficial atheism, and that's what it is, because there's a blindness. In my worst pagan days, I wouldn't say something like what they say in those silly books that they write, because the blindness has been removed, and I smell Jesus. George said off the air that this Thanksgiving he was going to stop and smell the turkey. Well, you can smell Jesus in everything you encounter, every story, every narrative, every reading of history. It's there, and it's exciting, and it reminds us that we really do, as Christians, have something for which to be thankful. Hey, Kathy, have you acquired a guest for next week?
I have acquired a guest for next week, and you probably can speak to him a little better than I can, because he is a gentleman that used to serve years and years and years ago on the staff of the former church at which you served, Reverend Jim Stout.
And, great.
So he's got a lot to say about a lot of stuff. He's been down some really tough roads throughout his ministry. And boy, he's got a great story. I think he's written a number of books.
And his story is pretty dark in some way. So if that offends you, you don't want to be here. But God using James Stout in the lives of people all over the country. And we're going to talk to him. But buckle down, because he is authentic. So be with us next week, same time, same place. And between now and then, don't do anything we wouldn't. That gives you a wide, wide berth.